and try and develop a culture, a political culture, which looks at the long term, which I think is something we'd all agree with. So, Rupert, the floor is yours, and then you will take questions.
Yeah, thanks
a lot. Thank you very much for being here.
Neil, and thanks everyone for coming. It's a pleasure to be here. So the report's been creating a bit of a stir. This is the report. Do have a look at it. If you want to take away one of these beautiful items with you, then please put two small round gold objects in my hand before you leave the room. Otherwise, I'll take these back and move on with them. If you want to get the report for free, it's available now for free for download from the Greenhouse website, which is easy to find. If you Google Greenhouse now, we come up rather than Greenhouse adverts and so on, so that's good. One of the stirs has been in the Guardian. So here's the Guardian article. And here, in extremely small print, are the comments, which closed last night at 314. So there's an interesting debate there. So what's it all about? So as Neil says, I've got a proposal to end, or at least to seek to start to end, the chronic culture of short-termism that we have in our politics, electoral cycles, and in our business and economics with business cycles and quarterly reports and even more short-termist things than that. And when one's trying to think on a timescale of hundreds of years or thousands of years or hundreds of thousands of years, for example, which is the timescale for nuclear waste, then those kind of short-term cycles don't make a lot of sense. So what are we going to do about it? Well, before I say what I'm proposing to do about it, one more way of seeing the problem. The concept of democracy is one of my starting points. What does democracy mean? So etymologically, democracy means the people rule or the people govern. Now, I'm sure those of us in the Progressive Alliance would agree that at the present time, it's pretty inaccurate to say that in any very meaningful or full sense, the people govern in our society. So we don't even have AV, let alone PR. We're still waiting for the upper house to be reformed. We need also participatory democracy, many of us would say economic democracy, a serious localization. There are vast, vast changes in our society which are needed if there's going to be a real democracy. But even if all those changes occurred, we would still be in a society which ran the risk of being chronically short-termist. Why? Well, the way I like to put this is that the democratic institutions that we have at the moment, and even the ones that would be brought in if we made all those kinds of changes that we would all like to see, I'm sure, tends to still be focused upon the interests and wishes of present people, of people who are alive today. They are the people who vote and whose votes would count even in an improved and enhanced democracy. But a people, I want to suggest to you, is not something that exists as a time slice. A people is something that exists over time. It begins in the past, and it goes on indefinitely far into the future. And while people in the past, it's hard to harm them because they've had their time, people in the future, it's extremely easy to harm, and indeed in the extreme to prevent from existing at all. Whereas if we get things right, people in the future could have the chance to have a great existence and to go on indefinitely long into the future having that existence. So I want to say that we need to find a way of making democracy actually include future people. We need to find a way of representing them in our political system. So what would this mean? Can you give future people a vote? Well, obviously that's not really very feasible. So we need to find some form of, if you like, proxy representation for them. They need to have something like a proxy vote, I'm suggesting. Well, as I said, if we don't screw up so badly that we stop them from existing altogether, over time there will be far more future people than there are present people, which would mean in a democracy that they would outvote us every time. Right? They would outvote us every time. They would be the vast majority. So in order to express their proxy vote, if you like, I suggest that what we give them is a proxy veto. Because if they did vote en masse together, they would, as I say, massively outvote us, provided we don't screw things up so badly that we stop them from having the chance of living at all. So I want to suggest that we need proxy representatives for future people, empowered in our political system, to veto things that we want to do. And the people who are going to be these proxies, I'm calling guardians for future generations. guardians to represent the interests of these future people to us. So who should these guardians be? How should they be selected? Well, it doesn't make any sense for us to vote for them, because they're proxies for future people. They're there to express the votes that future people would cast if they could cast those votes. I suggest that actually all of us and none of us are equally well positioned to be these proxy representatives for future people. We could say, well, Greens are best place to represent future people, but that would be rather kind of begging the question. And I'd love you to give me and my friends the power to veto all decisions made in our political system. But it would never get through. It would be perceived as a cheat. It would be perceived correctly as undemocratic. We need to draw these proxy representatives from across the entire population. But I suggest that the only fair, reasonable, and democratic way of doing this is through the same principle that animates the jury system, which is random selection. That anyone and everyone has an equal chance to be one of these guardians for future people. So what I'm suggesting can be put in this way, that we need a super jury drawn from any and all of us to represent to us the interests of future people, and to represent that by having a proxy power that enables them to veto decisions that would affect future people adversely, that are made in our current political system. And that really gives you, from that kind of line of thinking, that really gives you exactly what my proposal is. So I'm proposing guardians for future people, guardians for the fundamental interests, for the basic needs of future generations, to be selected at random, as jurors are, to form a super jury which would sit above our existing political institutions and have the power to veto proposed legislation or to force a review of existing legislation that they adjudged based on their own deliberations, based on their seeking to uphold the basic interests and needs of future people, and based on the absolute best expert advice and assistance that they adjudged would be adversely affecting of those fundamental interests and needs of future people. So if you like, you could think of this as a third legislative house. You would have the Commons. Hopefully we're going to get a reformed upper house, which is also largely democratically elected. And then sitting above that, the house of the future, the guardians of future generations, able and empowered to act decisively where necessary to stop us from doing things which would adversely affect those who come after us. And that's really it. That's the proposal in a nutshell. You can read the full details of it and the detailed options for how to proceed. There's all sorts of questions. How long would they sit for? How exactly would they be trained, etc.? There's a million things that we can talk about if you want at a level of detail to settle, a lot of which is addressed in the report. But that's the idea in a nutshell, and I hope you find it at the very least an interesting and provocative one. One of the main things that we at Greenhouse want to do with this is very much to open up the debate, and we seem to be already succeeding in starting that. This is not a proposal that is going to be voted in by any government next week, but we think that too often think tanks base their decision making in terms of what they're going to say partly upon, well, could the government next week bring this in? Or at the very most they think something like, could the next government bring this in? And that's what they think would be a success if their proposal, lock, stock and barrel, was put into place by this government or the next government. But that means that too often there is a chronic short-termism in the way that think tanks think as well. They don't think long-term, they don't allow themselves to have visionary, bold ideas that people may at first attack viciously, as has happened to this idea to some extent in the Guardian comments, and much more so in a wonderfully awful piece in the Telegraph that some of you may have seen, attacking the idea from one of the charming people over at Spiked. Think tanks too often don't want to expose themselves to that kind of attack and do want to do something which is perceived as the kind of reform which could be brought in by this government or at the very most by the next government. I'll be pleasantly surprised, but I'll be very surprised if the next government brings in this reform, lock, stock and barrel. What we're aiming to do is start a debate, is to put forward a visionary proposal that over time may come to be perceived not as so extreme, but as something eventually akin to almost common sense. And if we manage to do that, then maybe one day there'll be future generations that are grateful to us. And who knows, maybe this day may even be remembered a long time after many of the bits of technocratic tinkering that the large majority of think tanks have as their bread and butter are long forgotten. So I'm interested to know what you think. Let's have a discussion.
Thank you very much, Rupert. Blimey, there's a big idea, isn't it, to get us going for the first meeting of the year. So we mess around. Right. Questions, comments, thoughts? Exactly how farmy is it, or how exactly doable is it? Send them.
Rupert, thank you very much. If such a jury is well suited to deciding on the interests of future people, why isn't it suited to deciding on the interests of current living people?
Good question.
Yeah, that... Yeah, it's a really good question. So one of the influences on this report is the work done by Anthony Barnett, who apologised for not being able to be here this morning, and others on proposals for reforms of this general nature to our existing parliamentary institutions. So Barnett and others have proposed, for example, that rather than having the upper house elected, the upper house should be sortitionally selected, as jurors are. And that this would be a better way of balancing out the electoral mechanism with an alternative democratic mechanism. Barnett points to the fact that, of course, sortition was the primary democratic mechanism of Athens, ancient Athens and certain other ancient Greek cities, etc., which are well known as the birthplace of democracy. So in that sense, this is very, very far from being a new idea. I think there's quite a lot of virtue to that suggestion. I would be quite happy to consider proposals for an upper house that was selected by sortition. It doesn't seem to be on the agenda at the moment, but maybe it should be. One reason, as I hope I've explained, why this proposal is, I think, peculiarly appropriate to representing future people is that it just isn't possible to have a reform such that future people can vote. That idea literally doesn't make sense. So we have to find an alternative mechanism. And I think sortition and a super jury is the best solution to that problem. That doesn't mean that it wouldn't be a potential bigger part of our existing democratic institutions. It could be. But I think that the question of whether it is or not is orthogonal to the question of whether it should be the way in which we attempt to represent and proxy for and take care of future people. The suggestion I'm making is that there is quite a reasonable case for having a stronger role for juries, super juries, etc., in our current democratic institutions to democratically represent present people. But whether or not you buy that case, the case is overwhelming with regard to future people.
Okay, yeah.
So the short answer is no, but the long answer is a bit more interesting. There is an ombudsman in Hungary for future generations. They've actually had reasonably strong powers. I talk about this in the report. The ombudsman has sent a message of support that I'll be reading out at the House of Commons this evening for this proposal. The Ombudsman's powers have actually been reined back quite a lot by the current right-wing government in Hungary, so that shows that he must have been doing something right, I think. The Ombudsman's powers, though, even as they were until December 31st of last year, literally 10 days ago when the powers were reined in quite a lot, unfortunately, were still not as strong as the powers that I'm proposing. And in my view, as I explained in the report, were not sufficient to guarantee the interests and basic needs of future people. If you look at what the Ombudsman in Hungary actually managed to achieve in the last few years, it's significant, but it's not what Churchill would describe as enough. It's not a question of doing enough, what the Ombudsman, I think, has managed to achieve. There are other interesting experiments or institutions in various other countries that are worth comparing to what I'm putting forward here. There's a quite interesting parliamentary body that looks at the future in Finland. There's something similar in New Zealand. There used to be a similar body in Israel, but it's now kind of gone into abeyance, which again is interesting, a sign perhaps of its having gone further than the political institutions there were able to tolerate. There are, of course, quite interesting developments in Latin America, in some Latin American countries, although they tend to be emphasizing the supposed democratic rights of the earth as opposed to the democratic rights of future people. I'm a skeptic of the democratic rights of the earth. I'm not sure that's an idea that makes very much sense. So there's plenty of kind of partial precedents. There's no full precedent. The closest there is to a full precedent is what was famously in place in various Native American tribes, which I again address in the report, the idea of always looking to the interests of the seventh generation in any serious decision that gets made by the tribe. That's actually the closest there is to a full-scale precedent for this, and I think it's quite an inspiring one.
We'll take a few of those.
There's a fascinating idea here, this Rupert. It's just really. I'm just wondering about the mechanism. You probably deal with this in the book, but its selection of the super jury seems to me is critical to making the whole thing work. Yeah. Because there is a. How would they be selected? How would there be agreement? I mean, how can you get agreement to select a jury that would. By the very nature of it, they need to be radical people. But if you're looking for agreement across party to select people, you often go for the lowest common denominator, the people who are safest. How can you get away from this super jury just being full of grey men and grey women?
Don't worry, we'll select from the Progressive Alliance. Let's just get them. Yeah.
Thanks very much. We've come rehearsed a little what you said. Together through the Alliance for Future Generations, but I very much welcome the debate as we go, and you're focusing on an area where my goodness we need some creative thinking and some practical action as well. My problem with it stems from the right of veto, and I think what I've realised because of talking to you about your work is that I think democracy is fundamentally about people who are alive today, not about people who have yet to be born. And I think the way to bring future generations in is to focus on all the ways in which you can equip people who are alive today, including some people who don't currently have a vote, to be long-termist and regarding of future generations. So I think you can work with the idea of rights of future generations, you can work with select committees, onwards persons and so on. But when we get to even your proxy idea of representing future people, to me, the idea of democracy becomes all twisted out of shape. And the idea of giving those people with the proxy vote a right of veto on legislation is really deeply problematic. And for all that you've brought in the idea of sortition, which I very much welcome, for my vision of democracy, we don't have any uniform visions of democracy. For me, it becomes profoundly undemocratic.
So, Andrew?
I suppose it's kind of built on that. There is a very philosophical point about democracy in a way that we don't know what future futures are going to decide to do. And obviously, I think it's a great idea and it really opens up that debate, but obviously and clearly it's part of a bigger shift towards a long-term way of thinking. But I would have thought that ways in which we ensure and create the conditions that future democracy can be exercised in. In a way, is the flip side of it. I suppose it's really asking the questions on the limits of what you said and how much else needs to be around it to make it actually workable. I mean, unfortunately, I think I'm coloured by being involved in too many multi-stakeholder democratic dialogues. And the idea of the Nolan principles, for example, which is supposed to be about being able to think above and beyond your own individual interests, is quite interesting. How difficult it is for people to do that. And so I think there's a learning thing, there's a way in which our society doesn't actually necessarily give you the resources and skills to do that. And it's the selectivity of who are the experts, etc. So I think there's something about creating conditions for the don't know.
Do you want to answer those and then we'll come back and get a last?
Yeah, the great questions. I'll start with Helena's. So Helena, as some of you may know, has been one of the leading lights in the Alliance for Future Generations, the emergent group of NGOs and individuals, which has, as Helena implied, played a key role in helping me to put together the ideas for this report, and I'm very grateful to the Alliance. And Helena, you of course run the Foundation for Democracy and Sustainable Development. So it comes back again, I think, part of this question, and I totally agree with you, it's a big, difficult and open question of what we understand by democracy. And for me, as I mentioned in my little talk, that partly comes back to the question of who are the people. Now, in a certain sense, I agree with you that we, the people who are alive today, have to take responsibility for making democracy work and for ensuring that the conditions for those who come after us are viable. As it was put, we need to make sure that we create the conditions that future democracies can exist and flourish in. That's absolutely right. But I think also we need to think that the people actually includes people who are not alive today and people therefore who are dead, and most importantly of all, because these are the ones who can be harmed the most, people who are yet to be born. I actually think we should try to include them, difficult though it is. How do we do that? I think one of the things we need to do is we need to really try to actually imagine what they would want or what they would need. And I think that to some extent we can succeed in doing that. There are various things, for example, I think it's reasonably easy to say that they would not want. I think it's very likely that a body such as I'm imagining would look a lot more negatively on nuclear power than our current political institutions do. Because nuclear power is just a fantastically short-termist intervention. Nuclear power gives you power, gives you energy for about 30 to 40 years, and it then gives you waste that we still basically have no idea what to do with for 300,000 or 400,000 years. And that disparity is so vast. It's the kind of thing that if we actually stopped and thought about all those future generations, I think we would start to think it's kind of insane. Now, why do we have reason to believe that this super jury would actually do that thinking? Well, for one thing, they would take an oath that none of the rest of us in the normal run of things take, that sought to have them seek to swear to defend and uphold the basic interests and needs of future generations, and I think that would make make a difference to them. For another thing, as I said, they would have the absolute best advice. People would be clamoring to scientists, people like us, academics, etc. Plus, of course, people like Spiked and Bjorn Lomborg and so on. But hopefully they wouldn't benefit quite as much as they do at the present time from media bias and from a loaded financial dice. When it came to the deliberations of the super jury, people like us would be clamoring to try to give them our best advice for what the basic needs of the future are going to be, what it might look like, what we can know, what we can not know, what we can try precautionarily to intervene against. And I'm optimistic enough to think that people who are given that responsibility, people who we trust to do that, people who we have swear an oath to do that, people who go through a long training process in order to put themselves in a position to do that. I talk about all of this at the end of the report. And people who got the very best advice would actually be better off than the rest of us and better off than our current political institutions at doing what's necessary here. So finally, to come directly to John's question, you said, John, by their very nature, they would need to be radical people. But I'm not sure you've quite grasped the radicality of the proposal. I mean quite literally that these people would be picked, like jurors are, at random from the public. So they would be a complete cross-section with a couple of codicils. There would be the right to, there would be an enhanced kind of right to opt out which ordinary juries don't have, because it would be, of course, a bigger commitment. It would be a commitment of a period of years rather than a period of weeks. Although, of course, you occasionally do get juries who do have to sit for years, but that's the exception rather than the rule in the current system. Neil jokingly said, we'll select from the Progressive Alliance. And it's a joke, and why is it a joke? Because we know that that wouldn't be acceptable. You can't load the dice in that way. If this is going to be democratic, it has to be about all and any of us. And so again, it's a huge leap of faith, but that is just the leap of faith that democracy is, believing that ordinary people are actually people who, in the final analysis, you can trust with a very significant amount of power. And I think what would be essential would be to make sure that if something like this was going to be brought in, that there were enough checks and balances to make sure that power wasn't abused in terms of corruption, tampering, so on and so forth. I discussed some of that stuff in the report. But I think that's at the level of detail. At the level of grand vision, I think what this is really about is, are we prepared to trust ordinary people to make these big decisions if we put them in the right kind of context? And I think we should be prepared to trust them, and I think they do a better job than our existing House of Commons.
I'm warming up to this. Like, get the last batch, I don't know, Hillary, yeah, and then Katie.
So I'm just absorbing.
Yeah, no.
And I suppose my question is really, bouncing off some of the things you said about training, for example, I'm thinking, what are the forms of thinking required? What is the kind of mentality and assumptions behind that required for people in the present to think for generations in the future? And if people can answer that question, then surely, does one need a special institution? I suppose I'm wary about an institutional solution to what may be a problem of mentality, of governmentality. And as if we can solve that problem, what's involved in thinking about future generations, then if we can answer that, then maybe we can think of ways of building that into our present procedures. I mean, two points there. One is, remember, the GLC, when we got the Great London Council a long time ago, but we, at the end of one of our policy papers, we have what was called concurrence. It's not global government jargon, maybe, but we had to write a concurrent policy for women, a concurrent policy for women. People are good imagining that we have a concurrent. All policies have to address the implications for the future. The second point left is that actually, I don't think we should be so down on the rights of Mother Earth and God, because in a sense that is almost suggestive of one of the elements of the mentality of thinking about future generations. Because it's not, it should be interpreted literally in sort of the rights of the earth equivalent to the rights of people. It's more, I don't know, I'm just interpreting it metaphorically, it's more to do with understanding the sense in which earth has a dynamic. And sort of developing a respectful relationship with the dynamics of the earth. And surely, if we explore that in more detail, that's a crucial element in the mentality of speaking about future generations, that relationship to the earth.
Did you want to say something, Anna?
Yes, I'm very interested, Anna, sorry I was late. Would you mind about whether this is a danger of the extremely fascinating constitutional form you're proposing swamping out or rather overshadowing the debate you might have about this sort of thing, about how we can all be concerned with, more aware of, more committed to protecting the rights of generations? Because for me, in this discussion, there's a danger of getting into the detail of how this organisation would work. I think it's quite a nice set of proposals, but then I think the most important thing is to widen out the debate and try and get people to everyone, whether it's as common, as laws, institutions, NGOs, to take account of a certain matter of priority for the needs of future generations. And just one question, do you address the issue of intergenerational equity in sorry if you mentioned this earlier. Yeah.
Okay. So, Katie, you know, David?
I couldn't build on the last two points, actually, because what I was going to say is, I mean, many of us and people in our society will live to be 100. One of the challenges we have at the moment is simply having 20-year-olds and 80-year-olds in a room thinking about the interests of each other. It's perfectly possible for people to do. I mean, I took part in a systems jury, but it's the issue of pension reform, and it wasn't that, you know, it wasn't as relevant as yours, because it was free market research, but it was a representative panel of the population. And that was really interesting, because actually, when you do give people expertise, we're all perfectly capable of actually thinking, 20-year-olds are trying to maybe get on the housing ladder, 80-year-olds are thinking about care and supporting later life. So I suppose I'm coming a little bit more from this kind of pleasant situation as well. And I think what's great about this idea is it can stimulate exactly that kind of thinking. And we need to be able to think about 100 years. And at the moment, it feels as though society is really, really struggling with the kind of radical approaches we need. It shouldn't be that there's going to be a whole chunk of your life where you can do things other than full-time paid work. And we need to talk about something like that. So I'm quite excited. I think this idea also brings us back to the present thing about that. We shouldn't assume that that people aren't capable of doing that, because they're already doing some of that. But that's not what we're doing.
David?
If you ask which political tradition confronted time, tried to absorb time into its discourse, the most obvious answer would be the nationalist. If we were sitting in England, we could have the nationalist one. If we were sitting in Edinburgh, we could have an intelligible conversation about Scotland in 1,000 years' time, and just as we could, mythologically, about Scotland in 1,000 years past. Don't we need to think a bit about the boundaries of the group from which the jury were ever selected? You mentioned Hungary. You also used the word tribe. Putting tight bounds around the group would make it, in theory, much easier to think about absorbing time and the interests of future generations. And, you know, putting it to a dramatic point, I mean, they clearly are right at centre of the traditions, which do base themselves very much upon the long dure and the absorption of time and interests of future and past generations.
Yeah.
Michael Buckley, also a member of the Alliance for Future Generations. I really welcome, Rupert, your opening up debate about these issues of future generations, and I think there's very interesting questions about juries, particularly whether they might, for instance, play a part in things like public law hearings regarding administrative law and precisely kind of decisions about how we're talking about. But I think there are two different things here. There's, on the one hand, the question of the role that juries and sortition can play in democracy, and on the other hand, the issue of looking at the rights of future generations. And I don't think the two necessarily tessellate. In the example you gave, for instance, of tribal councils, which I think are very, very interesting, what you're actually talking about there, I suggest, is more the power of consensus in blocking decisions than in juries and blocking decisions. And if you look at the examples of both the Ombudsman in Hungary or the Committee for the Future in Finland, I'm not aware that particularly has a sortition-based particular part in that. But beneath that, the philosophical questions that I think need to be answered in your proposal are, firstly, where do you see the power that the jury would wield as coming from? Is it the ballot? Is it some folk power? Or does it come from some popular revolution? But beneath that, why do you think that juries are likely to be wiser or more prescient than any other elected body?
Okay. Yeah. To wrap up with those, and I was just going to say that, I mean, from a matter of kind of PR, I would talk more about future generations than future people. It kind of, future people sounds a bit weird, you know, generations. But and I also think it ties in very much with the kind of Ed Miliband stuff about the British promise, which I think is one of the concepts he should develop more, this notion that we pass on a better world than the one that we inherit, and that feels, you know, quite close to that. And I just wondered if there are any, what are the best examples in a slightly developing work where David was coming from? What are the better examples from history of decisions which have been about investment, about sacrifice, about long term, which you could play up and use as a, you know, in it, whether it's Britain or wherever, as kind of shining examples to say, look, they did this then, you know, and it's had an effect for generations, to use as an example to encourage people?
Mm. Thanks, Neil. I'll start with that. I like to talk, and I do a bit in the report, about cathedrals and orchards as great examples of where people in the past used to think on a really long-term basis. It was natural to them in a way that's become unnatural to us, and we need to put that into reverse. Why do I say future people sometimes rather than just future generations? Future generations is, I think, very much a sort of policy wonk term, actually, at the end of the day. It's not a term that actually has much resonance with ordinary people. Now, future people, I think, is a term that would also sound odd to a lot of ordinary people. But, you know, today's weird is so often today's tomorrow's common sense. The reason I use the expression future people is to try to nudge people towards starting to think, we're actually talking about people here. We're just talking about people who are not around yet. Right? We're not talking about some kind of dreamy, totally abstract thing or some kind of policy wonk theoretical concept. We're talking about real people. They just aren't alive yet. And that's how I think that term can be helpful. David, in terms of the Hungarian and Finland precedents, you're right, of course they're not sortitional, but that's why I think they can't have stronger powers, and I'm proposing something with really strong powers, right? That the Hungarian ombudsman is basically an administrative appointee. In order to have an institution with very strong powers, it needs to have a clear democratic basis, and basically that has to be either done through voting or through sortition. So that's why I'm suggesting sortition as the way. You're absolutely right in your points about boundedness of a people. And of course, I hope one of the virtues of this proposal is it can make sense to people on the right as well as people on the left. Again, something like that is going to be necessary to getting the consensus which will be necessary for ever bringing anything like this in. So Burke, for example, is a famous example. I quote Burke in the report. Burke talks quite explicitly about a society, as a partnership between those who are dead, those who are alive, and those who are yet to come. And I'm hoping to nab a few Tories with that and get them behind this. Anna and Katie, intergenerational equity, well, absolutely. One of the reasonings behind the proposal is finding it quite unsatisfactory that in our current political system, the vast majority of the consequential choices by people in power are made by people from one generation, basically. They're between their late 30s and their late 50s nowadays. So they used to be going into the 60s, but the 60s is a bit old for us nowadays, apparently, in politics. It's sort of coming down the upper limit. And I just think that's not good enough, really. Why shouldn't people who are young or who are very old play a real part? And of course, those people would be eligible for selection to be on the super jury. Now, you raised the question, Hillary also raised the question, well, yes, but why can't all of us do this? You know, why restrict it to one group? Well, this is, of course, partly a matter of practicality. We live in a huge society where deciding everything by a direct democracy or participatory democracy is not possible. But remember that one of the virtues, I hope, of the proposal is, of course, absolutely precisely that any of us could be picked as members of the super jury. While the vast majority of us know that we are never going to be elected to Parliament. And so in a certain sense, we don't have to bother thinking about these things. Right? But if the Guardians were brought in as I'm proposing, then everybody would have to think, my name could be picked out of that hat. I might end up being one of these super jurors. So I actually ought to start thinking about these things more seriously. I can't sort of outsource this thinking in the way that you can outsource thinking, if you like, to a large extent in representative democracy. So in that way, I would hope that this would actually be part of creating a spirit in all of us of thinking more about these issues. And I actually would hope that this would be part of creating a more genuinely deliberative democracy in this country. To come back to David's thought, of course, one of the key things also about thinking genuinely long-term is it becomes harder and harder to think purely within tribal or national boundaries, because issues that affect other countries are going to affect us more and more on the longer time scale, right? Basically because of the way that environmental issues, which tend to be many of the longest term issues, spill inevitably across boundaries. So when one's thinking about the future of Britain, one also has to think more about the future of the world than one does if one's thinking about the present of Britain. What does that mean? It means that It means that guardians for future people in this country would also have to pay attention to the interests of people from other countries to some extent in the future. And I think this would be a good thing. But what I'm suggesting is that a genuinely long-termist perspective within one country actually inevitably willy-nilly becomes to some extent a global perspective. And that's actually a very helpful sort of accidental effect of the proposal. And finally, in terms of campaigning for this and discussing it, I think just the act of doing that could be what Tom Crompton calls good cognitive policy. And I think this is consonant with what Anna and Hillary and Katie said. Just thinking about this and talking about it already makes everyone who participates in those discussions more open to these kinds of issues. So I think one of the virtues of this is, even if we never manage to get anything like this brought in ever, just talking about it in the way we're talking about it will already have positive effects and actually push us somewhat in the direction of being the kind of society which this kind of proposal is designed to try to create.
Fantastic. Thank you very much, Rupert. All hail the dreamers. Everything that feels, you know,